Welcome to the Econews Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of EPIC, the Environmental Protection Information Center. And for the show, we're going to the state of Oregon, and we're talking with Nick Cady of Cascadia Wildlands about his successful recent lawsuit challenging logging that was going to harm the endangered marbled murrelet. Welcome, Nick.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for bringing this case. I was totally excited when the decision came across my desk that you were successful in this lawsuit. And I have to say that I've always wanted to bring a case like this. My organization, EPIC, in case you didn't know, we brought a murrelet take case back in the 90s against Pacific Lumber Company for kind of a similar set of facts. To see your work continue on in that legacy is really fantastic. So thanks for bringing this case. And let's get into some of the history behind it. Where in the world are we talking about here? I introduced by saying you're up in Oregon, but what's this forest land like that we're talking about?
Yeah, so the forest parcel that was sued over is part of the larger Elliott State Forest, which is a big contiguous, about 100,000 acre coastal forest that's near Coos Bay along the Oregon coast. It's pretty unique. It's unique in terms of most of the coast range in Oregon is kind of checkerboarded up and fragmented in terms of logging and unlogging. This is like a large, contiguous, relatively unlogged forest that burned about 150 years ago. So it's prime endangered species habitat and functioning old growth forest.
Is that your dog in the background?
Yeah.
Hey, pup. So it is a large coastal forest. And it's home to one of the most interesting species in our Pacific Northwest, the marble murrelet. Would you like to give an introduction to this weird seabird?
Yeah, it's a funny species. I mean, as you mentioned, you guys brought that case. We cited that case heavily, and that's laid a lot of the foundation for our lawsuit. But yeah, the marbled murrelet is kind of like a little potato-shaped seabird. It's like the southernmost relative of the puffin, I believe. And so it spends most of its life at sea fishing in kind of the nearshore ocean. But it comes inland to, among other things, lay an egg and breed. And there's some other kind of nesting behaviors associated with these like forest areas. But yeah, it nests way up in coastal old growth. It is severely susceptible to predation, especially by corvids and jay species. And so it's very secretive about its nesting. And so it nests very high up. It flies in from the ocean dusk and dawn at times when there's low light. It flies very fast and relatively quietly. Yeah, and it lays its eggs on small mossy depressions. It doesn't even have kind of a nest per se, but depressions on lateral big limbs on old growth forests.
Right. Its nesting characteristics are so unique that it is dependent on these very large, very old coastal trees, right? So it needs to be within 50 kilometers of the ocean. And if you imagine a bird just trying to build a nest on some moss on the top of a Doug fir, right? You have to imagine that Doug fir branch is going to have to be very thick, very old. Along our coast from Washington all the way down here to Northern California, we just don't have much of these forests left. They have historically been logged. Just by its nature, there's always only a narrow band of potential habitat because there's only so much forest that could exist by the coast. And so we've logged the marble murrelet nearly out of existence. And so it's been listed since the 1990s. It's listed under the Endangered Species Act on the list. It receives kind of unique protections for that reason. I think it's recently been listed under the Oregon Endangered Species Act. Is that right?
Yeah, coinciding with this lawsuit, which has taken 7 to 8 years, we had a uplisting kind of process with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to kind of get state-level protections on other state forest lands in Oregon for the marbled murrelet, including more vigorous survey requirements and also just to encourage the state of Oregon to pursue federal habitat conservation plans for its state forests as well.
And I'll end our discussion about why the marbled murrelet is so interesting with this fun story. So for a long time, we knew that there were marbled murrelets because we could see them out at the ocean and we'd see them flying inland, but no one knew where they were nesting. It was this kind of scientific mystery. And it wasn't until the 1970s that we discovered that marble murrelets nested in these big old trees. And it was somebody doing some canopy research, and they were climbing up to the top of a tree in California. And was startled because as he was going up the tree, he looked over and saw a murrelet. And thankfully, he knew enough about birds to realize how weird this was and how no one knew before. And so I just kind of imagine this scenario where this guy's using his almost rock climbing equipment to go up to the top of these big old trees. He's going up. He sees the bird. He's startled. The bird's startled. Everyone just has this moment of, oh, what is going on here? We've only recently known about murrelet nesting behavior, so we lost so much of it before we ever even knew that this was a problem. But now we do know, so we have this unique obligation in this moment to protect existing murrelet habitat because it is so rare on our landscape. So here, the Elliott State Forest, this was the area where your lawsuit took place. It was a state-owned forest, but then it was transferred to a private forest company. Can you talk about that process and maybe some of the long fight over how the Elliott State Forest should be managed?
Yeah, the Elliott story is a pretty amazing one. So I have to mention Frances Etherington here. She's a kind of bulldog forest watch advocate in Oregon and has been on the tails of the Bureau of Land Management, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and the Forest Service for years trying to encourage responsible land management practices. And one of the forests that she was monitoring and field checking repeatedly was the Elliott State Forest. And for over a decade, she was documenting old growth timber sales, reporting on different endangered species violations, and sending this off to the Oregon Department of Forestry. And they were just not responding at all to those comments. But this monitoring and this continued information gathering have established like a pattern and practice of the state of Oregon logging and taking marbled murrelets. In 2012, I believe, filed a marbled murrelet take case against the Oregon Department of Forestry for logging on the Elliott State Forest. The district court in that case issued a forest-wide injunction. We shut down 15 old-growth timber sales. The entire timber program on the forest kind of halted for a while. That was a huge victory, but the state in response was so, I think they were pretty flustered and angry with us. In response, they're like, well, we're just going to sell it to a private timber company, like the entire big forest. And so they went through a process to sell the forest to whoever was going to be the highest bidder. Because this was nice old growth, they didn't have a good per acre price, but they didn't know what the valuation of the forest was. And so they sold three test parcels. One of those is Benson Ridge, that's at issue today. There was two others, Adams Ridge and East Hockey. The problem with that approach was that there's a statute in Oregon state law. It's one sentence long. It says you cannot sell the Elliott State Forest. Being a lawyer, sometimes it's not too hard. And so we sued him over violating that. And that went to the Oregon Supreme Court, and we won that case. They said, no, you can't sell the Elliott State Forest. But the problem with that statute, it says you cannot sell the Elliott State Forest as it existed in 1914 or something like that. And so this Benson Ridge parcel was kind of a newly added piece. They were trying to build more of a contiguous chunk of nice older forest. And so that piece still transferred to Scott Timber, Roseburg Forest Products. And kind of while that sale, we submitted numerous letters to Roseburg, indicated that we had positive murrelet survey results from that parcel, told them not to buy it, told them it was a bad investment, warned them that there would be an Endangered Species Act violation, told us to brush off. So yeah, and then we kind of got to our lawsuit ultimately.
All right. So Roseburg purchases land, and then how does private logging work in Oregon? Did they have to submit some sort of permit saying, like, we anticipate logging in this forest? What was the setup for the lawsuit?
So in response to our notice letter, like, it was a notice of intent under the Endangered Species Act, which you have to give a party 60 days notice prior to filing a lawsuit. They indicated that they had no imminent plans to log the parcel, right? And so they were kind of deferring us from suing right away over it. But under Oregon law, the tricky part of its intersection with the Endangered Species Act is you only have to give 15 days notice. And so there's no authorization by the Department of Forestry either. Like, it's not some permit that they're granting or some sign off. You just have to notify them. And so that absolves the Department of Forestry from any liability as well, because it's not any action taken on their part, which facilitates this logging. So in response to that notice that we got the 15 days notice, we jammed together a massive restraining order injunction motion and was able to get that filed in the necessary time and ruled upon prior to them logging any of this parcel. And Judge Aiken ultimately ruled in our favor. It was appealed, and the Ninth Circuit said that the judge applied, it was kind of a ticky-tack procedural ruling and said the judge applied the wrong PI standard. But it was clear from her language and from the court hearing, and we had presented some kind of early expert testimony, and she was going to rule in our favor. So defendants ultimately agreed voluntarily to stay logging after that early PI win. And so that was in 2015 or 16. So since then, there's been a stay on the property, which gave us time to litigate this case. Otherwise, functionally, it's almost impossible to bring an ESA case against a private entity in Oregon because you have to give 60 days notice. They only have to give 15. As soon as it's logged, your case is moot. Because, you know, we're private entities suing under the Endangered Species Act, the only thing we can request is injunctive relief to stop the logging. We're not suing for money damages or anything.
Yeah, we've had that same problem here in California, and we had a really interesting relationship back in our Headwaters days when we were litigating our Murrelet take case, where we had the same problem. You need to give notice that you're intending to file this lawsuit, but the timber company will just run in and do as much damage as they possibly can in that short period of time. We had a cool relationship with our local Earth First chapter then, where they would go out and prevent logging by putting their bodies in the way, by doing other things to hold up logging while that clock ticked. So it was a really interesting relationship, informal though it was, between EPIC as like the entity that would bring the lawsuit and like the civil disobedience from Earth First to hold it up. Was the timber company here, were they able to get out any of the old growth? Was anything harmed in this process, or were you able to stop the destruction?
Yeah, no, nothing got logged, no roads put in. And so we moved as fast as possible. It was a monumental lift in terms of legal work. Kind of Dan Cruz, who was the former legal director of Cascadia Wildlands, was working. He was the primary attorney on the case and was working 18-hour days. We were hustling every day to pull this off.
So this is under the Endangered Species Act. What part of the Endangered Species Act prevents a timber company from doing something like this? Can we talk about kind of the legal theory of the case here?
Sure. The legal theory is pretty straightforward. So the Endangered Species Act has Section 9, which is like the take provision, which pretty much prohibits any entity, be it private, state, or federal, from taking endangered species. Take is kind of broadly defined as either harm or harassment of an endangered species, and that has been interpreted to mean kind of adverse modification of occupied habitat to the extent that it impairs breeding, nesting, or sheltering.
And we have the ability as environmental groups to enforce the Endangered Species Act, which is fantastic, right? So there's something called a private attorney general's provision or citizen suit provision that enables a group like Cascadia Wildlands to go in and enforce the law. Because I know, too, that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is able to enforce the law, but they often refuse to do so for political reasons, because the Endangered Species Act is so disfavored by both Democrats and Republicans. No one likes it except for environmentalists and people who want to protect the earth. And so it's often left to groups like us to do this work, even though it should be the federal government that enforces these federal laws.
Right. So that's like the reason we provide that 60-day notice. It's an opportunity for the Fish and Wildlife Service to step in and litigate these cases. We were in touch early and often with the Fish and Wildlife Service being like, hey, we have like occupied survey results. This is like plain old growth occupied habitat, going to be clear cut. There's like no ambiguity here. This is take. And the Fish and Wildlife Service was like, you'll never win this lawsuit. That's what they said to us. And so that was pretty. Yeah.
Yeah. Send them a copy of the decision and tell them to reevaluate. Right. And there's a Humboldt connection to this lawsuit, too. So you have to prove that the activities that are planned are going to result in taking. Right. So there's some evidentiary standard that you have to meet. And we had two marble murrelet experts that helped here. Can you talk about the work of Dr. Gary Falxa and Dr. Richard Golightly?
Yeah, Dr. Falxa was the former head of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Murrelet program, pretty much. And so he was eminently qualified to testify about the species, and he did a great job just kind of objectively informing the court of all this marble murrelet science and background, because there was a good effort by the other side to kind of just confuse and derail every possible issue there was. And Dr. Golightly, down from Humboldt State University, is another preeminent marbled murrelet researcher and scientist and studied all sorts of aspects of the species. Both of them were really qualified, really expert witnesses. The court found that both of them were well qualified and spoke strictly to issues which they were informed about and researched and knew about. So,
yeah. The Eco News Report, we're talking with Nick Cady of Cascadia Wildlands about their recent victory protecting marble murrelet in the state of Oregon. One of the things I thought was funny about this opinion was that the timber company had the audacity to try to challenge their subject matter knowledge here, right? So Gary Falk's a great friend of the podcast, great friend of EPIC and the North Coast Environmental Center. He was at the Arcata Fish and Wildlife Service office, as you said, the lead there for murrelet issues, worked on murrelet issues with the Pacific Lumber Company for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, served on the Pacific Seabird Group's advisory team on murrelet issues. Dr. Go Lightly, if you look at the published science on marble murrelets, his name is all over it. He is, again, a total and thorough expert in the subject. So for them to say, no, our industry biologist that might have master's degree from Oregon State University or something, you should trust them, these people that have a financial interest in this case, over these objective scientists who have decades of academic and regulatory knowledge in the subject. So thank you to Richard Golightly. Thank you to Gary Falksa for your work here in protecting Oregon's murrelets. Tell us about the court decision. Ultimately, they sided with you. What did the court find?
I think the point I should touch on that's like the wildest aspect of this case.
Yeah.
That has to do with the defense expert witnesses. And so they had a scientist, Dr. Stephen Courtney, who was their big murrelet expert in the case. And he was a Cambridge PhD. He was kind of the go-to for the Fish and Wildlife Service on population viability, really. And so he's talked about wolves and grizzlies and butterflies and, you know, all these species have recovered and are fine and will survive and not go extinct. And he was kind of their go-to guy for those purposes. Well, so during the case, while that injunction I mentioned was on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, a friend sends us an article from some Santa Barbara paper. And it's like, hey, isn't this the doctor that's, you know, the defendant's expert in this lawsuit that you're bringing? And it's the title of the article's, you know, local birder caught peeping or something like that. And I guess Dr. Courtney was inviting colleagues down to his Santa Barbara mansion and had toilet cams and stuff. And so he was busted and ultimately convicted of a number of counts of electronic peeping, among other things, I think. And so he was wiped from the case. But as a result, defendants really had no bird expert at all involved in this litigation, which was pretty wild.
That is wild. But
yeah. And so we were trying to figure out how to get this before the Ninth Circuit on a PI appeal that really, you know, it was an interesting just whole procedural junction as well, you know.
Yeah, bird peepers, and now we have other kinds of peepers. So,
great. That was a great headline.
Yeah. Oh man, how embarrassing! I love stuff like that emerges in litigation too, or when you're doing research into folks, you discover all of the kind of skeletons in a closet often. All right, so. Let's get to the court's decision, and then we can start to kind of break down what this might mean for the Elliott State Forest and for kind of forest protection in Oregon, because we also have some exciting private forest regulation changes in Oregon. So what did the court find?
The court found that logging of this Benson Snake parcel, this was like a specific like little forest stand within the larger area that they had purchased, was going to cause take of marbled murrelets. And so that was kind of the only claim. They found it would not only cause take through, there's kind of two prongs. It was both harm and harassment. And so it was harm through like direct occupied habitat modification and then harassment, and that it would significantly impair breeding and other social and courtship and other mating behaviors within the stand. And so that was a great decision. The judge issued a permanent injunction so that could not move forward in the forest. And crucial to her finding was kind of an analysis and deep review. The opinion was very long and detailed of not only kind of the marbled murrelet life history and background, but of the really turned on the Pacific Seabird Protocol, survey protocol. And that's where a lot of the case centered. You mentioned the Pacific Seabird Group. Yeah, this is a group of scientists and land managers and federal agency personnel. It's a combo of everybody that makes recommendations on kind of Marble Murrelet's land management framework. And so one of the key focuses of the Marble Murrelet, because they're such a hard species to detect, they're nesting hundreds of feet up in trees, is kind of determining where and murrelets are nesting. That's one of these critical questions. And so the court found that the Pacific Seabird Survey Protocol was kind of a reliable method for surveying, primarily because both plaintiffs and defendants and every land manager known to anywhere, this is the only protocol that exists. So this is the only one people use. Every expert on either side said as much. And so the judge relied heavily on this, being like, pursuant to all these surveys that were done, I mean, there were hundreds of detections for the course of several years throughout this timber sale area. And notably, one of our surveyors in 2014 got clear occupied detection right in the middle of the logging unit. There were occupied detections all throughout the survey area. And then there were, I think, just under 200 presence detections, which means that the bird is kind of not necessarily exhibiting nesting behavior, but is flying in or around the forest stand there. So,
yeah, it's hard to have an affirmative documentation of nesting, but we often see that presence behavior where they're flying under the canopy. And to me, that seems pretty obvious that they are nesting, right? That is why they're flying into the forest. Okay, well, let's talk about what this means for the Elliott State Forest. So the Elliott State Forest, the state was trying to get rid of it for a while, as you said, was trying to sell it off. We have had some big kind of legislative change, and this Benson Ridge parcel is adjacent to the Elliott State Forest, so this is attached to it as well. So what's going on at the Elliott State Forest, and how is it now better protected than it once was?
Yeah, so all of this has been occurring in this broader, huge policy campaign around the Elliott State Forest that's been going on with a bunch of private entities, Oregon State University, the Oregon State Legislature, and the Oregon Department of Forestry. And what it's ultimately come down to is the Oregon State University kind of expressed an interest in acquiring this forest and having it be serve as kind of a research forest. And that gave us some pause because Oregon State University has been historically and continues to be associated with, it's one of these foremost forestry schools. So it pumps out a lot of the silviculturists that are planning old timber sales and saying it has this ecological purpose or justification or whatever they try to label it with. We spent years negotiating with OSU because they wanted to do some like legitimate research down there. And so we wanted to come up with a framework that would protect and be enforceable, like kind of the old growth forest down in the Elliott, and ensure that those areas weren't logged. There was also kind of a dichotomy, a legacy of original federal transfer of the land to the state of Oregon, where these forests were logged and the receipts for those forests were going to pay for Oregon schools. They were called common school fund lands. And so that was also problematic as well. So like we didn't want timber receipts from these forests to go towards Oregon schools. Like there's got to be a better way to fund Oregon's education than logging old growth forests, right? And so we wanted to eliminate that financial tie as well. And so over a couple different legislative sessions, we ended up getting $220 million allocated to sever that common school fund tie, right? So no longer were these receipts needed to generate money for the common school fund. And we also tucked the forest into this OSU research forest framework. And we kind of built in a number of substantive safeguards for the older forests. I think basically OSU is going to be limited to doing intensive forestry for the vast majority of the forests who already logged plantations. And the older forests that are largely concentrated in the eastern portion of the Elliott there will all be protected. So we're pretty happy about that outcome.
And we also have a big change in the way that private forests are going to be managed. Briefly, I know that there's a less direct connection between this and your lawsuit, but folks here in California have always regretted how Oregon's loose forestry rules impact our state. So timber companies in California always would moan and complain about how we are overregulated here and how Oregon does it right. And so I'm so happy to report that Oregon has finally strengthened its forest rules. So can you tell us a little bit about this Forest Accord and the changes that are underway?
It's funny, all these processes are kind of happening at the same time or have been happening at the same time. So it's been this pretty wild several few years. Yeah, so this private forest accord, there was about a dozen private timber companies and a dozen or so conservation groups kind of came to the table. It was facilitated by the Oregon governor's office. And what facilitated these discussions, and the discussions were about updating the Oregon Forest Practices Act, which has been the weakest, least regulated forestry practices in the country when compared to the deepest red states like Idaho. Like, our forestry laws are the worst. And so the conservation community had worked up some ballot initiatives for improving some of these forests and taking off, especially kind of headwater streams out of the logging rotation basins that were on private lands. And in response, the timber industry had worked up kind of a takings ballot initiative that would make the state of Oregon pay for any regulatory changes on private forest land, which would effectively preclude any meaningful regulation of private land logging in Oregon. The polling for both of those looked pretty good. And so it facilitated a come to Jesus moment for both parties. And so everybody met with the governor's office, and through a year and a half of negotiation, there was like agreement reached on some major substantive reforms that involved kind of aquatic management. So many headwater streams or intermittent streams or seasonal streams weren't protected at all in Oregon. There were no protections for steep slopes. Leave trees for a host of reasons were just woefully inadequate. I mean, it's kind of one of those things, if you ever fly over Oregon, you can see it from the plane. There's complete sections of clear cut, and it mirrors the checkerboard land ownership pattern. These riparian buffers are no longer going to be associated with leave trees. Like, they are permanent, non-negotiable riparian buffers. And so we're hoping that the landscape that you would see from a plane is going to change over time. It's going to be more of a spider web of forests along rivers. We weren't able to reform clear cutting practices overall. There was a number of issues, but the reforms also touched on a bunch of stuff like beaver trapping, aerial herbicide application. It was a pretty broad and far-reaching agreement. We had kind of been biting around the edges on a number of reform efforts. We had filed petitions through the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on murrelets and coho salmon to try to force protections there. We had also filed a few successful petitions with the Board of Forestry, also on salmon, to try to get protections. And this all kind of culminated in this process. I want to be clear, it's like Oregon's forest regulations are still, this process is not over. You know, like, we notched in a first step that was badly needed, but there's a long way to go for how we look at our forests, especially in the light of fire. You cannot clear cut every 40 years and put a fire dense plantation right next to people's homes or federal forests. And it's just, the whole program needs to be looked at and reviewed in light of what's happening with fire these days.
Yeah, fire and climate change, they're really kind of changing what we think we know about how to manage forests. And a lot of new research is coming out that backs up exactly what you're saying, that clear cuts increase fire risk, and that fire risk is highest on private forest lands compared to public lands. So
we just won a big lawsuit up here. It was a designated recreation area, and the Bureau of Land Management was like, oh, before we build those mountain biking trails, we're going to clear cut it. This was just outside of town in Thurston Hills, just outside of Springfield, Oregon. And people, you know, there was 300 residences adjacent to this parcel that they were going to clear cut. And the BLM admitted in one sentence, their environmental assessment was like, yeah, this clear cutting is going to increase this area, which was kind of like an existing mature forest. It was kind of a low to mixed fire severity regime where it was low incidence of fire start, low severity. So they were able to have attack and control a fire if it started there. And they admitted that their clear cutting would increase both the risk of ignition of a fire and the severity of a fire in that area from low to high for the next 40 to 50 years. And it was just kind of a one sentence thing dismissing that issue as insignificant. And all the landowners were like, how is this insignificant? And they kind of scrubbed their 12-page fire hazard report from the administrative record. And the judge was not pleased about that. So this isn't just like conservationist scientists. This is the most logging heavy agency in the United States is admitting this as well. This is pretty well accepted at this point.
Nick, thank you so much for all that you're doing for Oregon's forests, both private and public. If folks want to learn more about Cascadia Wildlands and your good work, where should they go?
Yeah, you should check out our website. It's www.cascwild.org. It's caskwild.org. you can always give our office a call too, and we can be happy to chat and fill you in more.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Nick Cady from Cascadia Wildlands. Thanks, Nick.
Awesome. Thank you, buddy.
Yeah, see ya. Have a wonderful day, and thank you, listeners, for listening to this episode of the Eco News Report. Join us again next week on this time and channel for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.